Welcome to the Into AI Safety podcast, where we document my shift to a career in AI safety. This show aims to serve as a mentorship proxy for those getting into the field and a mentorship amplifier for our guests and myself. As always, I'm your host, Jacob Haynes. You may hear this sound, which denotes that I have included at least one link related to the content that preceded the sound. The purpose of this is to allow for citations and providing resources without breaking the flow of conversations. As per usual, items mentioned during asides will have links in the show notes as well. Get ready, gang, because today we'll be cracking into the last hour and a half of my interview with Dr. Peter S. Park. Before we get into it, if you haven't listened to the first two episodes of the interview series, what the hell? How dare you? Just kidding, it's not necessary to listen to them, as I think this one stands on its own, just like the last two. But they are definitely worth your time and may clarify a few things. Irregardlessly, Dr. Park is a postdoctoral fellow at MIT working with Dr. Max Tegmark on AI existential risk research. In addition, he founded Stakeout AI, a nonprofit with the intent to make AI go well for humanity, in collaboration with Harry Luck and one other co-founder, who will remain nameless to invoke an air of mystery. No, but her current position requires her name be removed from previous advocacy efforts, so here we are. Sadly, Stakeout AI had to dissolve near the beginning of March 2024 because no grantor would fund them, despite the team having already established a good track record with regards to making realistic, consequential goals, and then materially advancing towards them, as was made clear in the previous two interview episodes. I know, it doesn't make sense to me either, but we can at least take solace in the fact that Dr. Park, Harry, and their third co-founder are continuing to contribute towards a positive future for humanity within their respective domains of expertise. Now, today, we'll hit the open source, closed source debate, which is currently central to the questions surrounding the governance of AI systems, provable model safety, and even suggestions for how to get up to speed and more involved regarding these topics. Like I said, today's episode is long, so let's get into it.
Remember the art, AI art companies, right? Mm-hmm. They tried to rush it through, right? They tried to scrape all the data, steal all the copyrighted hard work of the digital artists, train models on them, rapidly improve on the artistic capabilities of those models. Mm-hmm. And then artists go from 2022 Midjourney, which is, you know, a party trick. It's still pretty impressive in some way, promising, but mm-hmm. you know, nothing you would buy at a market, art market, to like just a complete replacement thread in just 1 year. And this was all very rushed. And the fact that it's being rushed and the fact that it has negative externalities is probably very causally related, as you mentioned. And the whole like explicit or implicit plan is like rush it through, get people to give up, get the victims to give up, and just be like, okay, like this is the new world order. And I think this is like...
And I mean, that's, again, that's a very authoritarian...
that is literally textbook authoritarian vibes right there.
Right.
And I think like, that's why I think, you know, Holly Elmore's Pause AI is the leader of Pause AI US. Pause AI is a global grassroots movement. The whole idea of slowing it down is like, it helps us make choices better, right?
Right.
And I do think like in a lot of situations, you shouldn't slow it down. But I do think this is definitely a situation where the case for slowing it down is much, much stronger. And there's a reason, for example, Professor Rich Sutton in his talk at the AI succession, which is a talk at the World Artificial Intelligence Conference in Shanghai. If you look at what he said we should absolutely not do, it is exactly what Pause AI is doing. It's like,
God,
clamp down, try to control everything, slow things down. Like it.
Right, yeah, I mean, it doesn't... Yeah, but if you then just look at it from
right.
from the lens of,
yeah.
like, who has used this strategy in the past?
Yeah, the ones with the authoritarian vibes, you know, just...
That's the... Because if
yeah.
you can hoodwink people,
Exactly.
Into the situation where then you have all the power.
Exactly.
Now you don't have to care about what they're thinking anymore.
Yeah, yep, that's exactly right. And I think this is, again, remember the exercise where assume that the person truly thinks they're doing the right thing. Professor Rich Sutton, like, he's telling us the truth. Like, he's telling us Moore's Law, if we extrapolate it, we'll have human brain level computing power for just $1,000 in mm-hmm. just 6 years. Mm-hmm. And he's saying there are two things we can do. We could slow down, clamp down, control things, or we could just let it rip and we should not resist. And he's like, I choose option two. And he's just telling us the truth. And I believe the truth part, but not the normative part, where it's like, no, I go with option one. Like,
yeah.
I will just do the opposite of,
and,
you know.
but I guess the thing is that, like, let's say that he could achieve that. He could get there.
Right.
What gives him the right?
Oh, nothing. Like, we live in a democracy, no.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I guess that's sort of like, but like right now,
yeah,
it does seem that, I mean, nothing, it's not as much what gives him the right, it's
right.
What says explicitly that he can't do it.
Exactly. So it's almost like they somehow, by omission, gotten us to compromise, yeah. You know, the rights part. And I think it's great if we can, you know, inform and get people aware that we do have rights. Like, we can, right. You know, vote, and we can write and call our representatives. We can do that. Again, the whole difference is, like, if we give up or if we just do nothing for whatever reason, then we will be just allow this to happen. Because the other side, they're definitely in the direction of making this happen. But if we exercise our rights, I do think we're the winning side if we exercise those rights.
Okay.
And I think people,
I mean,
often,
that's good to hear.
Yeah, because, like, we out, they have all the money, but, like, they have no moral standing, right? Because of everything you said. They're just trying to do the thing without caring about everyone else it affects. They used to have basically boatloads of money and the reputation as, like, oh, the next technological step. They're the seers of the next technological step. You had Sam Altman do a world tour, right? Mm-hmm. So they used to have all the money and all the reputation. Now they only have the money. They don't have the reputation. It's just people have soured on them, I think. Again, and the broad, not just digital artists, but a broad coalition of people have soured on them. And they just have the money now. But I think money is powerful, but it's not everything. Like, if you're AI collaborationists, and that threat is made tangible to people, you could have all the money in the world and nobody will take it. I think we just have to make sure that happens.
Okay.
So I do think if we take the threat seriously, we are the winning side and we're the team to beat, although it's not guaranteed.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
So one thing about the pause AI that I think is sort of an analogy that I had recently that I think may be worth discussing a little bit is just...
Right.
In mechanical engineering and in aerospace engineering, in those two domains and product development within mechanical design as well, there's a very important thing called the safety factor.
Right.
And what the safety factor is let's say you had a material. So let's say we just have a stand, like a table. Let's say the table can take 500 pounds of weight.
Right.
It can take 500 pounds, but at 501, it certainly breaks.
Right.
You wouldn't say that it takes 500 pounds. You would say it takes 50 pounds with a safety factor of 10. That safety factor is really important.
Yeah.
It feels like there isn't any sense of a safety factor.
Yes, that is entirely correct. In fact... Remember the scorecard? The scorecard that our nonprofit, Stakeout AI, researched, and it was presented by Max Tegmark as part of the Future of Life Institute's proposal at the UK AI Safety Summit. So this scorecard one of the criteria of scoring was quantitative risk balance.
Okay.
We can't do that. The scientific understanding does not exist currently to do that. So everything you said cannot be done for large language models because we just don't understand things like, okay, like if we have an open source, if we have an open source like image generating model, mm-hmm. how do we make sure that it can create CSIN?
So that's
child sexual abuse material. So the Civitai, this is a AI image generating open source startup funded by, of course, Andreessen Horowitz, the of Mark Andreessen fame, the EAC cult member,
yes.
Billionaire who thinks, you know, it's good if AI cannot be controllable by humans. Literally. And let's suppose a Civitai somehow got its act together, which somehow, like, this is not true right now, but hypothetically, let's say, you know what, yeah, let's make sure we have quantitative risk bounds for ensuring that our models can create CSAM, or that probability of it being, you know, prompted to create CSAM is, like, very low, lower than some percent. There's no real way to do that, because our understanding is very low. We could do empirical tests. We could be like, okay, we did these test cases of these prompts, and it was fine for these cases. But then it wouldn't be general. It would only apply to those. So just because of the sheer complexity of this paradigm of, like, there's all sorts of potential prompts that could go into this model, and the way the output is created from the input is just completely, I would say almost completely now, since there is important but still very nascent interpretability measures, interpretability research being done. But yeah, we just like can't make good, you know, meaningful quantitative risk bounds. Just like unlike other systems, such as those in mechanical engineering,
right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess that one thing that so in mechanical engineering and product design specifically,
right?
The safety factor is super important,
right?
Like because the thing is, if it's a consumer facing product,
right,
you have to assume that they're going to use it in the absolutely worst imaginable possible way.
That's the right level, I think, especially for AI that can replace humans.
So for children's toys,
right?
You know, like one of the, like those blocks or whatever, those have. It's not just like a, you know, oh, they're probably good enough.
Right.
Like, there's a lot of testing that goes into understanding,
right,
like, how much of a beating can this really take?
Right.
And so it just doesn't, but it feels like even an amount of that would be very beneficial. And maybe the reason, so, sorry, getting back to, like, why did that happen? That was the real question of, like, why was this idea of the safety factor so ingrained into product design? And I would assume that it's because of litigation. If you're giving this toy to a 2-year-old, you can expect that the 2-year-old is going to do whatever they want with it.
Right.
So you need to make it like something that is going to withstand whatever they want to do with it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something related to that. I don't know. That's the only, because
go ahead.
The reason I was bringing it up is just maybe that's something to leverage. Like, find the analog in consumer-based products, and then like figure out why is it so necessary now that, you know, for these toys and games and stuff like that, there's such a high threshold for safety.
I think one reason for children's toys, we as a society, most people want to really protect their children and go above and beyond with that,
right,
which is why I think a lot of the early wins in getting AI regulations passed is related to protecting children. Things like protecting girls from non-consensual deepfake pornography. There, if you just get even a small snippet of video of like a minor,
mm-hmm.
anyone from their peers at school to, you know, whoever, you know, see Sam enjoying a criminal, anyone in the spectrum can just create it. This is the current situation with, and because, like, open source image models, because we don't understand them, like, our understanding of them is so low, we can't rule out anything as, like, being safe with respect to this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one reason, I think, why the safety factor for children's toys is very important, and I think why the early wins in AI regulation are probably going to be protecting children. Also, more generally, things like a lot of, I think, the first frontier for social media regulation in general, I also expect to be protecting children's well-being. You recently saw Mark Zuckerberg and other big tech CEOs testify. Do you know about this? They testified in front of the Senate, and they got a grilling, and they're just like, you know, they very bipartisan too, and there was senators from both parties being like, this is, you know, your product, basically saying, like, you know, basically allowing users to access CSAM or do child abuse. I believe something like this is true. You should watch the highlights.
Okay.
Of it's just a very bipartisan grilling. And again, I think there are two forces here. One, of course, is most people in our society, like just normal people who are not out of touch, we really care about protecting our children and protecting our children's, like, future world, right? Like, making the world good for our children and their children's children.
Right.
Most people are like that. Also, whenever a new medium is introduced, the first thing that, you remember, like, the children trying to break it, the first thing that people try to break it is with, like, pornography, and I guess, like,
right,
you know, child pornography as well, unfortunately. So,
yeah.
And you know, non-consensual pornography in general. So you have these two forces where, like, the backlash factor is quite high to begin with, and then you have among the early adopters, a bunch of people who are, you know, going to be like the kid, like, just trying to screw this thing up, and that screwed this thing up, unfortunately, for new internet media, a new computer-based media, is like pornographic, and, you know, even child pornography or non-consensual pornography for the case of AI. So, yeah, so I think we as a society need to just like shut it down, like,
mm-hmm,
just and do whatever it takes to shut it down, even if it means, like, you know, if open source image models, if you can't show, like, if you cannot demonstrate that they're safe with respect to CSAM outputs, then, you know, tough luck. I mean, even if CSAM is only one of the use cases, we just have to shut you down. I think that's, like, personally, that's the appropriate level of response, and I think most people who are not out of touch, who do want to protect their children and their children's future, will have that same mindset. So it does not exist yet, this equivalent of the safety factor and equivalent regulations for AI, but maybe we are in the process of achieving that. Maybe,
mm-hmm,
I do think the backlash.
Well, so if you can establish then,
right,
that it, like, I could, if you think about it from, like, okay, the toy company is going to put out this toy.
Right.
If this toy is used in a way that is dangerous,
right,
like, if this puts the child in danger because they are using this toy,
right,
regardless of how exactly it was,
right,
then there is threat of lawsuit and
right,
like, class action suit against,
right,
the maker of the toy.
Yeah.
So having a similar thing for,
yeah,
like, what, like, models that are put out,
right,
of, like, oh, you're that, even if it was like a third party takes,
right,
yours and they build off of it, they fine tune it or they do something, but they the starting point was your model,
Yeah.
There's some level of accountability that can be drawn from that. And so the people who put out the model unsafely can be held accountable in some way.
Yeah, so class action lawsuits are excellent. I hope for each of these extremely terrible harms, there's a class action lawsuit against the big tech AI company making it. I do hope that happens. Lawsuits are good. Like, New York Times copyright lawsuit is excellent. One, because it's a copyright lawsuit that has real teeth. I think, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I don't give legal advice, but people, including legal experts, have been saying it's quite strong.
Okay.
So, also, there's a signaling aspect to it, right? If New York Times, which is like a very, very prestigious traditional media venue, makes a lawsuit, that signals to the other journalists to be like, okay, like, this is a threat to our livelihoods.
Yeah.
Before it was unclear, or there was enough of a unclearness that big tech social media, social influence campaigns could kind of muddy the waters enough. But once, you know, the big dog makes the move and everyone follows in, like,
Well, it's also a signaling for the companies,
right?
It's a signaling to the AI companies that we are willing to sue you on this,
exactly,
in a robust, like, well-defined manner that actually is going to be able to, you know, cost you a lot, effectively.
And that, so, you know, and New York Times is not playing around in their lawsuit. They said, we demand the destruction of models trained on our copyrighted data without our consent, which is
impossible.
Impossible.
They're already out there.
Oh, but the models are not out there.
Oh, okay. I thought some of them were.
No. So if it was Llama, you're correct.
Okay.
Llama, they just spread the weights. They everyone from North Korea to your local cyber criminal can just download the weights.
Right.
For OpenAI, it's API access. So,
right.
So they can demand.
So they're saying for the ones that we can do that.
Yeah.
Like, big companies, you can't host this anymore.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
So if you're hosting it, you have to destroy it. Is their demand, and this is like, again, the negotiation strategy is very helped if you have something like, if you don't play ball, like, we're just going to destroy your model. So, like, if they don't give you consent when you're asking nicely, you do also need a big stick to,
right,
just even if you're just quietly holding it, right? To refer to President Teddy Roosevelt's famous quote, speak softly but carry a big stick, I believe.
Yeah.
Is quote. Something like that is a quote. So I think that's excellent.
Cool.
I
want to talk about, I have two more, like, concrete
please,
things that I want to make sure
please,
we address. The
yes,
first is, and we sort of segued into it, but open source, closed source.
Before forging ahead, I would like to give what is probably my longest aside yet. Let's talk about some of the terms and resources that are mentioned in the upcoming section, which is centered around open source. Open source was coined in the late 90s to describe software which makes its source code openly available. In general, it has been shown that traditional open sourcing of software promotes innovation and scientific advances, increases robustness, security, and safety, and prevents monopolies and the predatory practices that monopolies often take advantage of. Importantly, the value associated with open source is almost entirely dependent on transparency. One specific example where this is clear is with so-called red teaming. The idea of red teaming has its origins rooted in the 19th century with the development of war games. Traditionally, one side was red and the other side was blue. Eventually, a convention was established that the red team were the aggressors and the blue team were the defenders. So, red teaming is when a friendly group attempts to find and exploit weaknesses in a given strategy or product in order to inform the design team, or the blue team, who will in turn attempt to patch those vulnerabilities. When a software is transparent, the team that maintains the software gets access to an expansive red team that can also sometimes suggest valuable solutions. Open source software has had many more people scrutinizing it, resulting in more robust outputs. The last thing to say about open source is that current AI models do not fit nicely into the open source definition, which is maintained by the Open Source Initiative, or OSI. This is because a singular model is defined by and is composed of multiple different artifacts, that is, the weights, the data, training algorithm, architecture, etc. Another term which is thrown around in this section is weights. This is a tricky concept, so I will link to a solid video from 3Blue1Brown on machine learning if you're interested, but I will try to build intuition for it very quickly here as well. So, my first attempt ended up being an expansive analogy that I do think is helpful, but we don't have time for that. So, basically, weights are the settings to apply to a neural network that makes it actually good at whatever its task is. For current cutting-edge models, it is very expensive to obtain these, but once they have been determined, they can be used and adjusted for other tasks very inexpensively. What Peter will soon refer to as wide release of model weights refers to models whose weights are easily available to anyone. In most cases, the licenses placed on these weights do not even come close to those that would be certified by OSI. I'm looking at you, Llama and Gemma. The Mistral model's weights, however, were released under Apache 2.0, a license that is undeniably open source. Unfortunately, virtually all other artifacts necessary to make the model transparent are withheld. In order to clarify these distinctions for both the field and for the general public, I propose the following naming conventions. Open source models are those that meet whatever the current open source AI definition is, as established by the Open Source Initiative. All right, I'm pretty proud of this one. Runaweights models are those which release their weights but are not transparent and or they prohibit use in any way. I guess visible weights is also fine, but runaweights is so much more fun. Then we can think of open release as a term that encompasses both open source models and the runaweights models. Lastly, there was a really great paper published as part of 2023's Conversational User Interfaces Conference titled Opening Up ChatGPT, Tracking Openness of Instruction-Tuned LLMs, which investigated the ways in which many large language models are actually open source, and the ways that they aren't. They created an online table where all this information is summarized, and I will definitely be linking it in the show notes.
Yeah, so the Meta just spreading their model weights, downloadable by everyone.
Well, but you see, I guess there's something that I didn't realize
right.
until I started. So in the what I'm working on with the AI Safety Camp project is I'm going to be writing a series of articles on open sourcing versus closed sourcing because I feel like it's a really important debate,
right?
And it's sort of obfuscated by tech jargon,
right?
And just sort of spread out. So it would be really nice to be able to actually understand what's happening.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And so I started looking into this.
Yeah.
Someone at some point called releasing model weights open sourcing.
Yes.
And that's not really true.
I don't think it's meaningfully true. Because, well, it's a label, so...
Right. Well, I mean, so the thing is, it's shifting the definition towards that.
And it looks very much like a corporate social influence campaign.
Yes. what I think. I think it's... So someone, at some point, I don't think it was someone that really knew a ton about open source.
Yeah.
And I think that they were trying to get the idea of they're sharing this publicly.
Yeah.
And so they referred to, sharing model weights...
Yeah.
As open sourcing. And then, the industry movers latched on to that, and they were like, yes, we're going to call this open source.
Yeah.
Because it makes it sound more transparent than it actually is.
Exactly. And also there's this whole culture around open source software. There are programmers who think, they have a halo on their head because they do this for free. They create open source software. They red team other people's open source software. Because open source software, the benefits of it is because of this community aspect. If the software is transparent, then it can be meaningfully red-teamed by the other people in the community, which means if it's improved by the red-teaming and if it can withstand that, then it's robust, for example. That's why Signal, the messaging app, is very highly believed to be robust because there's this very strong community that has successfully red-teamed the software. None of this benefit exists for neural nets that are called open source, right?
Right. And there was actually a really good paper. I'll share it with you because I would like to publicize this. I'm going to include it in my article as well.
Yes.
But they went through a bunch of different models.
Yes.
And they basically were like, okay, in what ways is it actually open source?
Right.
And so similar to your scorecard,
right,
they have a, like, you know, 15 or 20 different items where they can have, instead of doing binary, it's three, then they have like little asterisks next to them.
Yeah.
But you can see which models are actually like almost open source, because none of them meet all of the criteria.
Right.
But like Bloom's is almost fully open source.
Yeah.
Whereas Mistral's models are not.
Yeah.
If you look at like the ways that they could be open source.
Yeah.
And so like, for example, for Mistral specifically, they believe their value add is in the data. Which I think is probably true. I think that there's been sort of a neglect on quality data.
Yeah.
And just instead just getting like
as much as possible
and using it. I think if you know, if basically the same idea of like what self-supervised learning self-supervised learning isn't anything besides like a clever way to utilize the data so that you can process a lot of it and like, so you have a formula for that basically.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do that in clever ways for like that are actually going to create good data, that's going to be really, really powerful.
Right.
So, in the publications of Mistral, I believe they never say anything. Well, they say, like, trained on multilingual data.
Yeah.
And, like, that's it. That's the only comment they say on data.
So, what you're getting at is the... What's not open is the parts of the information that is required for reproducibility.
Yes, there's no, but it depends on what the company believes its moat is.
Right.
So Mistral believes that their moat is data quality.
Right.
So they release the weights, but no one has any idea what data they're using.
Right. So they are, it's a bit sneaky because they are trying to get the public, you know, prestige benefits of being open source.
Open source.
But they're actually very strategically hiding the very thing that they think is their comparative advantage.
Yes.
Yes. I think, yeah, this is obviously true. Yes.
And so, but then even that, I would also go further than that and say, well, that's like definitely bad. Definitely not okay.
Yeah.
I think that there are some on the other side as well, like OpenAI, Anthropic, that are utilizing some of these arguments in not necessarily like the most well-meaning ways.
Yeah, because their whole thing is like, we are not like the crazy open source people. We put our model weights behind API access.
Right.
We are the responsible parties here. And then, you know, when you have the people who want to red team them, also people who are potential victims of their model's release, and just something like, hey, like, we want to know before you release it to make sure there are no problems. Then they say, oh, sorry, like, that would be, you know, then we would be like those crazy open source people. We have our experts inside in very secure conditions to do the necessary red teaming and experiments within the confines of our company. Trust us, bro. And I think this is surprisingly influential, despite how, you know, self-serving it seems. Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I agree with both that we need more transparency in terms of, like, if your models are going to do harm, then I think people should have a good quality way of making sure that the harms don't happen, or that they will happen and, you know, they will not be released or not even be trained. I think people deserve that. And at the same time, I also think, like, you know, just releasing model weights to everyone essentially with an internet connection is very irresponsible. I think both of these things are true.
Yeah, and so I guess that's sort of what I'm saying is, I think that when I first sort of like went into it, I was thinking, you know, I'm very strongly in the closed source
right.
like side. But the thing is, if you really, I mean, that also has a lot of those authoritarian regime qualities.
Yes.
Of like, oh, so you're the ones that are allowed to red team it.
Exactly.
And then, you know, once you say it's good, then yeah. everyone else can use it, and you're not going to let, and it, like, you know, that's you pressing the button. You're saying, yeah, we think it's good enough, so everyone is subjected to it.
Yes, and I think the biggest problem here is that the red teamer is a safety team. They, I mean, this is a classic tale as old as time. There's a company in a high risk industry that poses mm-hmm. potentially the public is exposed to high risk because of the activities of that company or the products.
Or not even the public, just like NASA, for example.
Yeah.
Back in the shuttle days, there's a great
the astronauts could be in danger.
Yes.
Yes.
So like the not the Challenger. I mean that as well.
The Challenger.
There are a couple others as well where it's like someone brought this up as an issue.
Right.
And it was sort of like waved off.
Yes.
So especially when the public's involved, but it's not even just no, dependent
right.
on that.
And I think like there's a tale as old as time in this situation, which is the safety team number one says, we found this critical safety issue.
Right.
It is difficult to resolve, expensive, or it is not solvable at the current level of understanding, or it's just not solvable. They say something like this.
Right.
Company fires them. If they try to whistleblow, company does all sorts of shady things to prevent them from whistleblowing.
Mm-hmm.
They hire safety team number two. Then safety team number two either has, they have a choice, right? They either do the same thing as safety team number one and then they also get fired, or they play ball and they
right.
learn to look the other way. So, like, this is probably one of the biggest threats to this, like, closed door, as you said, like, authoritarian vibes-ish strategy. The very people who are signing off on the safety of these systems, they have some combination of financial conflicts of interest and personal conflicts of interest.
Right.
Just also just pride in their field. Like,
right.
just, you know, I don't want, you know, this is very common, right? I don't want my research field or my industry to be the bad guys. I want to be the good guys. Just, it's, again, we have to, you know, understand that in their mind, like, they're probably thinking they're doing the right thing for, you know, their idiosyncratic reasons. So I think because of this combination of financial conflicts of interest, personal conflicts of interest, like the loyalty to colleagues and, you know, loyalty to your field,
mm-hmm.
This is the catastrophic failure mode for these closed door situations, I think.
Yeah.
In theory, this can be passed, although it will not happen naturally. It needs to be very intentional. Probably not self-regulatory. Most likely not self-regulatory.
Yeah, that's just one of the things that I think is especially interesting with the open source debate. Because
yeah.
I feel like the only two arguments that are
right.
really being represented
yes.
are beyond what makes sense in both directions. Like, by a pretty substantial amount.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of what I want to say, like, look, here are all the fallacies
right.
in both of these arguments.
Exactly.
Because there really are a lot of issues.
Dang. Two asides back to back where I have a whole lot to say. Well, let's get to work. This upcoming section focuses on the overlap between AI risk and bio risk. Now, this one, like all the classics, gets a little confusing, so I'll link all my sources in the show notes. Although risk stemming from biological and chemical attacks has been acknowledged for a long time, and the risks of pandemics has been acknowledged but ignored as well, the first academic paper, which even touches on the threat associated with advanced machine learning systems and chemically synthesized agents, was published in 2022, as far as I can tell. And it is titled, Dual Use of Artificial Intelligence-Powered Drug Discovery. In this paper, researchers used a drug discovery tool to generate novel toxic chemicals, and they basically say, This is a wake-up call. We need to have a serious discussion about what is and isn't allowed before barging ahead. Another important item to point out is that this paper is focused on machine learning models that are highly specialized within its domain. These models are currently referred to primarily as biological design tools, as far as I can tell. This is distinct from large language models, or LLMs, which are currently much more of a focus in the public eye. In June of 2023, Kevin Esfeldt's group at MIT released an informal preprint titled "Can Large Language Models Democratize Access to Dual-Use Biotechnology?" Although I think that this paper is overly alarmist, it does explicitly state that the experiment was not scientifically rigorous. But the team, quote, "judged the results to be concerning enough to warrant publication in order to address the vulnerability with non-proliferation measures," end quote. Okay, that seems reasonable. In September of 2023, the Center for AI Governance, or GovAI, published the paper "Open Sourcing Highly Capable Foundation Models." Alright, well, let's set the name aside for now. In the words of an author to a lengthy investigation into this paper, quote, "I examined all the biorisk relevant citations from a policy paper arguing that we should ban powerful open source LLMs. None of them provide good evidence for the paper's conclusion," end quote. Okay, well, that certainly doesn't sound good. What does the paper actually say? Quote, "In this paper, we have advocated for a risk-based approach that could be summarized as make open source decisions with care," end quote. Okay. Now, the important part here is just that I want to point out, at the very least, it seems that there's some miscommunication or misrepresentation of people's arguments going on here. We still aren't done yet, though. The main paper that is discussed in the following portion of the interview is titled "Will Releasing the Weights of Future Large Language Models Grant Widespread Access to Pandemic Agents?" And it was also researched through Kevin Esfeldt's lab. In this paper, although the claims that are mentioned in their prior work are expanded upon, there isn't a comparison to currently available tools. That is, could this information be gathered through Wikipedia or Google? Last, but certainly not least, is a paper which has been released since the recording of this interview titled "On the Societal Impact of Open Foundation Models." The paper proposes a framework for understanding what they describe as marginal risk. That is, the additional risk that society is subject to because of access to a technology relative to pre-existing technologies or other relevant reference points. The same group also released a policy brief, which is probably the most accessible yet still in-depth version of the content. In it, they argue that many currently proposed regulations place more burden onto open release models than what is placed on closed source models, effectively discouraging open source, which is well documented to be valuable for society.
I mean, for example, the biorisk.
Yeah.
When I applied to AI Safety Camp,
yeah,
as a research lead,
yeah,
my project was going to be very similar to the paper that Kevin Esfeldt published.
Oh, that's a really good paper.
So that was before it came out that I had that idea.
Yeah.
And after, then it got released and I was like, okay, well, I think that doing this would probably add to increase the likelihood that of like releasing dual use information, and like wouldn't increase the likelihood of good things happening.
I see.
And so that's why I redacted the project.
Right.
However, like, I guess looking more in depth at these, at exactly what was done in the paper, I would like it to be more scientific.
Yes. I think, by the way, this is true for many of AI safety research papers and directions. And I think, again, it's a pre-paradigmatic field, and that is a very new field.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's going to be a lot of, like, searching around in the dark. But I do think, like, that's true, but still, like, at some point we do want to become much more scientific. I think, like, that is always going to be, that should always be in the minds of everyone in this field.
Right. And so I guess that's one of the arguments that I see from the other side.
Yeah.
It's, like, basically pointing to this sort of idea of, like, well, when you look at the citations, for example, of, like, GovAI has a whole thing on, like, dangers of releasing model waves.
Right.
Which they don't call dangers of releasing model waves. They call something about open sourcing.
Okay.
Right, which is first an issue in itself.
Right.
But the citations go to either, like, non-peer-reviewed papers or papers that are, like, hedging. And basically, they're all saying, like, these are possibilities.
Right.
And then, but then they're taken at as, like, a, this demonstrates that, like, these are possible. And so then the other side of, like, Mistral, so I've watched a decent number of interviews of Mistral's founder.
Yes.
One of their key claims is, like, oh, well, the research that's, like, the main thing that people are saying is dangerous about large language models right now is bio risk, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's true at the public, or in the policy space.
Right.
And when you look at the research that's been done there, it's not really scientific because it doesn't compare what was being, like, how the LLM helps you to how a search engine helps you.
Right.
And so, you know, everyone already has access to a search engine.
Right.
And so if you're not comparing the difference there.
Right, because it's always about opportunity cost. It's
right.
Not, you shouldn't, yeah, it's not in the vacuum. I agree with this.
So I guess the idea being, like, I think that it would be, I think it's probably possible at this point,
right,
to show that that danger is concrete,
right,
even if it's small, even if it's like, oh, well, the language models reduced the time it took to do this by 10%.
Right.
If that's demonstration of reduction, and people right. are saying these models are going to get better.
So I think this is all sorely needed. One thing that I guess, like, again, safety researchers are very, the culture is, like, very, like, information hazards are real. I do think a lot of these scientific, even the scientific demonstrations, there is a trade-off between, I guess, reproducibility and, you know, security mindset in terms of information hazards. That is, and I guess, like, for, if bio risks were significantly increased because of LLM use and there was, like, an actual secret trick that, you know, hiding it could actually be beneficial, I guess the researchers can make that call at that point. Yeah, I guess one diagnose, I'm trying to diagnose why, what is the one cause of this, I guess, insufficient scientific rigor,
mm-hmm.
and how can we improve it? I think the AI landscape is evolving and changing very rapidly and mm-hmm. advancing very rapidly.
Yeah,
so,
that's definitely true.
Like, and imagine, remember the COVID pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it's, the situation is spreading exponentially, there is a trade-off between, like, speed and, like, investing time. Like, you have time, right? You can invest it into just acting on the incomplete information we have right now
mm-hmm.
and just hope for the best versus, like, invest time into higher quality research and higher quality information of the current situation.
Okay.
So there's this trade-off. And the thing that COVID pandemic taught us is that speed, like, in a rapidly exponentially expanding situation or accelerating situation, you do want to act quickly and act even on unclear signs or even when you have incomplete or low quality information. And that can be the difference maker that saves lives.
Mm-hmm.
If you wait too long for the most, you know, robust RCTs, maybe all the damage has already been done. So this
mm-hmm.
was a
okay.
very, and I think for AI, this is a very similar dynamic where the rate at which additional funding and additional talent and additional research and products is occurring in the AI industry is quite rapid. I mean, like, Moore's Law is literally a faster than exponential trend, right?
Right.
So in this kind of a situation, a lot of researchers do feel like, if they wait too long, their research will be obsolete, and also impact will be low. So I'm trying to diagnose the problem.
Yeah, no, and I so I'm also working with APART Research,
right,
expanding on the hackathon project,
yeah,
that we did,
right,
and I think that our timing is, like, really good, because everyone's starting to say, like, oh, our evaluation, or our data is contaminated. Basically,
yeah,
evaluations no longer have their meaning.
Right.
Because the,
oh,
evaluation,
yeah,
data has gotten into the, like, the evaluation data sets have gotten into the training data sets, either because, well, in multiple different ways. The main way that's being focused on right,
right,
now is explicitly getting into the data set.
Yeah.
The research that we're doing is, like, we think that it's implicit,
yeah,
as well.
Right.
And, like, if you train, if you, you know, do, if you do five different architectures,
right,
and you train them all or whatever, and,
right,
then you test them on the evaluations, and you pick,
right,
the one that performs best,
right,
that's, like, not good. That's not,
yeah,
good.
That's not fair. Yeah,
yeah,
that's,
exactly,
that's not a good test. I completely agree. And I think, so I talk about how AI safety is pretty paradigmatic and could use more scientific rigor.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to say, like, the AI field, which is more established overall, just machine learning field, they're very atheoretical. It's all, like,
yes,
do experiment. Do, you know, the what, you know, how to write a paper on, you know, to publish in this conference. Just put it through the sausage machine and you have a paper. And, you know, there's insufficient, I think, deep thinking about, like, you know, things like what is understanding in terms of cognition, you know?
Right.
Like, if the emails are in the, you know, training set, like, what's the point? Like, you know?
Right.
Yeah, just a lot, and also, you know, the fundamental problem of out-of-distribution generalizability.
Mm-hmm.
So, here's my take, and maybe it's a controversial take, but I think it's pretty clear, which is, like, let's say, like, you have these kinds of settings, right? And you only have data for a subset of the settings.
Okay.
And you're trying to be like, okay, how can I, like, generalize to these other settings, right?
Mm-hmm.
The most basic, most fundamental form of this problem is almost, like, tautologically unsolvable, right?
Hmm.
It's
okay.
Kind of like saying, okay, suppose I have a map of the left side of the world. And we have a good map, a good understanding. But the right side is completely unexplored. How can we, just based on the map of the left side that we know, like, complete the map to the right side without exploring, without getting the data?
Without getting any information.
Exactly.
Back.
And,
right,
you know, I think the obvious answer is, like, you have to explore the unexplored territory. And if you're trying to... and I guess, like, in theory, there could be situations where you could, like, extrapolate...
Okay.
But I think just this almost, you know, many situations you can't extrapolate like that. You're going to be surprised by the actual territory that's unexplored. And I, what's, you know, there's a lot of AI research that just aims to solve this unsolvable problem, right?
Right.
So this is what happens when, like, you know, research is considered as just, like, there's this method in our field and there's this metric of success. We're going to make the sausages that optimize on this metric. We're going to make the sausage, and we're not going to question whether the metric actually, whether what counts as good research is actually helpful in understanding and predicting. This also is true for AI. It's actually a very similar problem of, like, pre-paradigmaticness,
mm-hmm,
and atheoretic empiricism. The idea,
yeah,
of, like, just not caring about, you know, whether the... thing, you know, whether your measurement is, like, actually a good thing of what you,
right,
want to understand deeply. Yeah,
I think that we should blame the academic publishing industry for that. and I'm serious.
There's a lot of blame to go around, but I think they are probably, yeah, I mean, yeah,
I, because,
yeah,
I think so. I think, you know, obviously we can say there's blame,
yeah,
and different people have different contributions, but,
right,
I think fundamentally machine learning,
right,
as a whole has said we're done with academic publishing.
Yes, that is correct.
And because of that,
it has actually achieved, like, economically useful large language models. Is that what you're thinking?
No.
Oh.
Although, I think it's definitely good that they said that at first.
Uh-huh.
But because of that, now there's no framework whatsoever. And so no one has that, framework to go off of.
Right.
And to actually make good research and to write papers that are rigorous and well-written so that other people can read them and, actually understand what you were trying to say.
So there's, so right now in AI, we have a very interesting situation, as you said. There's a movement of being like, okay, we're going to just become big tech companies and just stack all the GPUs and, have sophisticated behaviors. We think that if we keep doing this, we will get super intelligence, autonomous AIs that can replace humans at work and maybe even replace us as a species. So that's a very, very unprecedented situation. And it's very interesting from how the academics like myself deal with it. And I think one way to productively deal with this is, sure, we don't have access to the weights of GPT-4. We can only do behavioral tests because it's only API access, right?
Right.
But that's still good for red teaming in some ways. We can red team things the papers you mentioned, although the scientific rigor could be increased, you could argue they were doing the best they can with the limited access they have, and it still made an important point. Another paper, I think, the AI deception paper.
Yes.
I sent you. This is co-authored with Simon Goldstein, Aidan O'Gara, Michael Chen, and Dan Hendricks.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is a very, very excellent 5-person team wrote this paper on AI deception. It's a survey paper. So we just looked at especially big tech AI companies, and when they release models, we just took note of which of these model behaviors could be considered learned deception, learned even unintentionally learned from the training process, even if the human developers it was not their intention to make it deceptive. So it was, again, the fundamental problem, I think, of a lot of the catastrophic risks of autonomous AI is the fact that it can deceive us. It can deceive the safety testers pretending it's safe when it's not. So it's a fundamental research topic. And even though, there was no p-values or whatever, we still were able to write, I think, a compelling survey paper of just, okay, these big tech companies are just going to do what they want and just release models like GPT-4 or Cicero. Cicero is the board game playing AI, where the board game is Diplomacy, which is a alliance building and world conquest game.
Yeah, it's like Civilization, but more complex.
Yeah, that's right. It's more complex because you can, I guess in Civilization you can send messages too.
Yeah.
But I think for some reason the messaging is quite important in Diplomacy.
Yes.
Yes, because you can just very easily gang up on, two people can gang up on their neighbor, for example. That's the idea is gang up on people and don't get ganged up, essentially. And using verbal messaging as your, the pen and the sword, so to speak.
Right.
So it's very interesting. And Meta actually did,
they trained a model to purposefully be deceptive.
No. That's how they trained the model. They tried to train the model to win honestly.
Oh, okay.
And they bragged about it in their paper published in the top journal in science, which is literally called Science.
Right.
So as a scientist, it's also this is quite concerning because for scientists like myself, getting a paper published in the top journal is an honor, and you wouldn't want to make claims that are motivated by profit rather than by the actual data that you're submitted with the paper. But I think that's what happened here at Meta, there's a directive from the top probably about we have to, make sure it looks honest and not like Terminator probably. That's something like that was said, and they packaged the paper to be it was surprisingly honest, won honestly, and when we actually looked at the dialogue data of the models playing against humans, it was very bad deception. There were many, many clear examples of systematically deceiving the humans into doing the things that would allow it to win. I mean, if in a game like Diplomacy, where your whole point is to build alliances and betray them,
it's honest in that its goal is to win.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And it did the thing that it would do to win. That's how it was honest.
And even though they try to train it to be honest, the training selection pressure to win overcame that. And
right.
Importantly, the meta employees were, nobody had either the insight or the courage to correct that falsehood in the paper that was going to be published, and later it was published in the top journal in science. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very problematic. And so that was an example of how a survey paper can still have a large impact, where it's like, oh yeah, you know, you're not going to tell us about, you know, you're not going to give us an opportunity to really have transparency at red teaming your models. Well, we will red team the best we can, and we'll find a bunch of still concerning problems, and we'll just say there could be way more. We just don't have access to it, but I bet you there is way more that they're not letting us know. So that's still productive, and I think. And I think, again, in a very exponentially, in a situation where you're exponentially losing control, like in the AI industry, as big tech strategy, I think acting on incomplete information and being resourceful with it, even as an academic, is like one way to deal with this situation.
So there are two papers here. The first is Human Level Play in the Game of Diplomacy by Combining Language Models with Strategic Reasoning, which was conducted by Meta's AI research team and published in the journal Science in December of 2022. Diplomacy, the game being referenced, is a war game that places emphasis on making and breaking alliances with other players. To give you an idea of what is expected during the game, the most popular online version is hosted at backstabber.com. Despite this, the paper explains that the model named Cicero, quote, conditioned its dialogue on the action that it intends to play for the current turn. This choice maximizes Cicero's honesty. End quote. I guess I don't really understand how this choice maximizes honesty. In fact, it seems that it would incentivize elaborate deceptions that take many turns to orchestrate. The second paper is one that Peter co-authored, titled AI Deception, A Survey of Examples, Risks, and Potential Solutions, and it explicitly looks at this example, among others. So, yeah, after further investigation into both of these papers, it seems that Meta's paper disguises concerning aspects of Cicero by not explicitly defining what they mean by honest.
Right. Yeah, I guess the argument, so just going back to like the bio risk thing.
Right.
To me, it seems clear that there is some point.
Right.
And this was corroborated by like a London-based think tank did this research.
Right.
And they brought a bunch of people from all over the spectrum on
right.
open source, and they got people together and they said, okay, let's talk it out. Let's figure out like what are the key things that people are worried about.
Right.
And basically everyone that was there was in agreement that at some point, theoretically, the model could get powerful enough that you would need to regulate it.
You mentioned this, and then except for the EX. The EX EX just claimed that the trade-off does not exist.
Yes. So that's the case, right? So the question then to me is, shouldn't we like make sure that things need to be safe enough?
Yeah.
No one knows what that threshold is.
Right.
People say, oh, I think it won't happen ever. Some people say that. Some people say, I think it's already here.
Right.
And people are all over the spectrum in that.
Right.
But the thing is, if you release the model,
right,
and then you can't take it back.
Which is the case for open source, or so-called open source.
I
call it wide release of model weights.
Yeah.
I think that's like the most accurate and honest way to describe it. Wide release of model weights. By the way, like, I don't know, like, imagine North Korea getting the weights, you know? It's...
Well, like, Mistral's,
right,
for example, I think that their approach was was purposeful.
Yes.
Because they released a torrent.
Yeah.
Which is hard to remove.
Yeah.
So I think they chose that on purpose.
Right.
To sort of, like, probe what people would do.
That's extremely scary if that's true.
And nothing happened.
Right.
So they've done it again. They've now released two models in that manner.
Right.
And I think that unless we can get established consensus on, like, you need to be verifying that your model is okay to be made public,
right,
in this way before,
right,
you do it.
Right.
And that shouldn't be just an arbitrary person. That should be through, you know, the government.
Yeah, it should be through a process, more generally, a process that is well thought out to, you know, remove the conflicts of interests influence in the quality of the decision.
Right.
And I think, again, like, government and, you know, when people talk about government choices for private companies, a lot of the people criticize it, and among them, the criticisms are also about the government has conflicts of interest too, right?
Right.
And to that, I would say, okay, like, let's just make sure that the process that we actually use, this is a field called mechanism design, which is it's a field in economics where you want to create a system of rules such that no matter which of these situations is true and you're trying to differentiate between them, the rules applied to that situation will result in a good outcome in that specific situation.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's difficult, but it's very doable, in like, at least you can progress in our understanding of how to do this, right? And like, if you have two sides that are saying, just give up, like, just have private companies control it, the government has conflict of interest, and the government is saying, just give up, private companies have conflict of interest, the safety teams, employees have conflict of interest. I'm just saying, like, hey, like, you know, like, just, there's a shared problem, which is, we want to improve the qualities of our decisions and, you know, get the best information possible.
Yeah.
And make the best call, which for OpenAI, for example, they're nonprofit theoretically has a fiduciary duty for the safety of humanity, right?
Right.
So I do think, like, government control has conflicts of interest as well in certain situations versus others. But one thing's for sure, the current situation, which is just self-regulation of these companies and these theoretical nonprofits that are actually big tech companies like OpenAI.
In some cases, they're just companies, though.
Yeah, like Microsoft and Google, Meta. DeepMind, Meta. They're just literal. They're beholden to shareholders.
Right.
And, you know, there are many situations where the shareholders' profit-maximizing interest is contrary to, you know, the people's public interest, to the national interest, and to the humanities interest. There are many situations like that. So that's just something that's true. And with AI, everything gets supercharged. So those conflicts, I think, can become magnified, which is why a lot of people are increasingly becoming concerned about them and directing their efforts to resolving them, even though their efforts are less money than the big tech lobbying efforts, the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, our nonprofits take out AI because there was so much important high urgency stuff we had to help resolve. We actually spent our time on high impact project advancement rather than on fundraising. We do have to fundraise eventually, so we're starting to fundraise right now. But for the longest time, we were just, you know, in this, you know, battle against the very big money, big tech companies and their lobbyists and their social influence campaigns. We had, like, just no fundraising. We were just, you know, three people doing what we can do, and we still made a dent. We still made a difference, and I even think it's a big difference based on the five milestones we've accomplished for AI going well for humans. But I think they do have a lot of money.
Money is really hard to overcome. That,
yeah, it's hard. It's not impossible.
No,
but it's hard. And that's why we need all the help we can get.
Yeah. So you mentioned, like, with Stakeout AI, I guess one thing that I was curious about is, what's your day-to-day, like, what does starting this nonprofit mean? I mean, it sounds like, you know, there wasn't really any funding, so
we have been effectively volunteering for free to just do the best we can to help our fellow, you know, humans, fellow people against this, which we think who are being not fully informed. Mm-hmm. So just because there's so many urgent emergencies situations, mm-hmm. and that we felt like we had to put out these fires, and you know, like eventually we have to fundraise, and we're fundraising. But
fundraising is going to make it so you can be more impactful too.
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's just it's unfortunate. It's an unfortunate travesty that the AI industry has been creating so many fires that we felt like we had the need to work for free in putting out these fires, thereby being unable to, you know, fundraise. So that's why I think, like, that's why we need a more united movement, right? They can get away with doing this if it's just a nonprofit of three people. But if a nonprofit of three people, there's many nonprofits, or if there's, like, even a grassroots movement of, like, regular folks helping us with their donations, with their volunteering, and even if, you know, for the most dedicated, like us two, just career changes from, you know, you're a mechanical engineer, now you work in safety. I was a mathematician, and now I work in AI safety. Mm-hmm. Just, we need more, you know, again, everyone is team human if they know that team human is under threat. So we just have to make that known. Your question, what was your question?
Well, I guess, like, well, I mean, that was a good part of it is, it sounds like a lot of what you're doing on the day-to-day, which is the question, is, like, assessing what needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
So, like, understanding the landscape.
Right.
And then trying to figure out, like, okay, what's the best way to allocate our resources to address that?
Exactly.
And then at least some of it was research.
Right. So, research I do through my MIT full-time job, working as Max Tegmark's postdoc.
Gotcha.
So that's the job I'm actually paid for. And in addition to that, I also do the job part-time of being the director of Stakeout AI. And my two co-founders are working full-time on Stakeout AI, which is the AI safety and unemployment threats advocacy, you know, grassroots movement building advocacy. And because we felt like we had so many fires to put out and so many urgent situations that we felt like we could be the pivotal difference maker
when we enter
because of our skill set, we just we got to work and we didn't have the time to fundraise, and we're starting to be like, okay, we have to fundraise right now. We can't work for free forever.
It's like the PhD student.
PhD students are actually paid though.
I just meant the mentality of like, I don't. At least how I thought about it, I wasn't taking care of myself when I was getting my master's. And that's sort of what I meant, of like,
you have to make strategic choices about your, for example, what project you do. And that's less in a master's degree than a PhD degree.
In a PhD degree, I think that there are many PhD, not all PhD students, but many PhD students who, like, let their health and their well-being slip. And that's sort of what I was saying is, like, it's not the same because it's not the same trade-off, but it is a trade-off of, like, I am letting my well-being slip because I feel like I've got to do all this other work.
Yeah, and to this, there are very similar situations like this, and I always say, like, I don't always practice what I preach.
Yeah. that's true.
But, I know in my brain, maybe not in my actions yet, but in my brain, like, you need 8 hours of sleep. 7 to 8 hours. Yeah, you need to eat well and be healthy. Like, because if you don't, you're going to burn out.
Right.
And it needs to be a sustainable, like, you're running a marathon, not a sprint, is what my co-founder Harry always says, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, people who know this in their brain, they still don't practice what they preach. And what they see as, like, oh, there's, like, all these urgent situations, these fires that I have to put out, which I think is, like, that's why, again, we can't let them get away with doing this, because, like, if they just tire us out with all their shenanigans by creating these fires, then that could be their whole strategy, which is why...
I mean, that's like a very common strategy.
It's a very common strategy, right? Just out tire them with your boatloads of money and just do something, even though you're just like 1,000 people compared to like a U.S. population is somewhere on the order of 300 million, right? So it's just... I think, how do you actually practice what you preach?
I don't know.
A lot of it is just agencies. Just be like, if, for example, when I was in fire putting out mode during the UK AI Safety Summit, up to that and the EU AI Act,
right?
And you know, when my co-founders were onboarded, we were all in the fire, we're in the situation, like. There was a moment where I realized, was like, okay, like if I just prioritize this, the problem's gonna get much better. It's not completely solved, of course, but like if I just said, okay, like I'm gonna, you know, for example, it's like no all-nighters period. You can make a rule like that so that you don't, if you're the type to make all-nighters and procrastinate until that point, if you make a hard rule that you're not gonna do that, that could go a long way, for example.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I do that for sure. Maybe I do have better self-care habits than the typical academic.
It would be great to meet the person who's like the median or the mean academic, because I've seen such a range. Right?
That's true. I guess I'm just like comparing to like my friends in school.
Got it.
And so I hate procrastinating. I can't do it.
Well, that's a good trait.
I do sleep. I
congratulations, that's really important.
Yeah.
I try to stay.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's another similar situation, which is like effective altruists, like, you know, we donate to things like mosquito nets to save kids from malaria, stuff like that, right? It's like, "Oh, we are actually saving children's lives." Which means there was a effective altruist, so I have to max out all my credit cards. And they eventually, you know, had to get therapy. This is also secondhand, so it's not a first hand, by the way, but I heard from someone that there was a situation like this where they got very obsessive about it,
right?
And they didn't prioritize long-term helping of people rather than just short-term, like, just max out helping people right now, even if it means, like, just... you have a lot of problems later down the road that prevent you from helping people sustainably. So I think sustainability of action is very important, which is, again, why when the AI industry tries to make it so that you have to put out all these, like, oh, yeah, last-minute EU AI Act lobbying spree. Like, and so, like, man, like, yeah. So I think, So if we have a lot of people on Team Human, it certainly goes a long way. If you have a lot of people, for example, in an army, like if you have two people, you have to take turns doing the watch guard, right? But if you have a lot of people, you have a lot more flexibility. And So, for example.
So the last thing that I want to make sure that we address,
of course,
is it's kind of twofold. The first is I was going to do it second, but I'm going to do it first because I want to make sure we address it fully.
Yeah.
Let's say that you're like, okay, I'm on board with what this guy, Spider-Man, is saying. No, I'm just kidding. what are the steps that you take? Like, let's say I don't want to switch my career into AI safety, but I want to contribute towards these ideas.
Yeah.
What do I do?
I think... there are three ways people can help. Actually, there might be four ways. So, the most important way is just spread the word. So, this is why I asked you to link my link in my bio, the Sacred AI webpage, because it has all our educational materials for, like, what is the AI race right now? Like, what is at stake? Mm-hmm. And if our podcast episode, through your hyperlinking, got that link to someone clicked on it and they shared it and they clicked on it and they shared it, that spreads the helpful message. So this is a positive exponential thread. So that's Always helpful. And what
you hear
would
that, guys? You need to share my show.
So share Jacob's show, and also in the process of doing so, share Stakeout AI's website with all its educational materials.
Yes, that would be really, really.
That's probably the first thing you should do, because
we're turning to talk to the mic because we're so serious.
Very serious, because it's so costless, right? You're just spreading it. It's just the first step. And right. In terms of the more, I would say, like things that you might take you a bit more time and effort, but are still meaningful. Number one, donate to projects you trust are helping move the direction in a good way. So things like Jacob's show, or things like Dr. Park's Takeout AI nonprofit.
That is a good call.
Yeah.
I actually don't even have something that people can donate to.
So that you should work on that. It's just like, again, the goal is sustainability. You want to set it up early so that you can help people sustainably. So number one, like just money is a fungible good, right? So donations go a long way. It can be the difference between even great, impactful people who do really, really important projects. They can't be unfunded forever, right? So like number two, number one is donations. Number two is volunteering. Even if you can't do a full career switch like other people do, that's okay. You can volunteer on your free time. There's a lot of, if you have a 9-to-5, that still leaves the weekends and after 5 to volunteering. And there are a lot of skill sets where remote volunteering work can be very flexible. And if you have the right skill set for it, you could go a long way just being a volunteer.
Do you have examples for that kind of thing off the top of your head? If not, I'll maybe you can send me some later, and I can just add them in the show notes.
So, like...
But I just want to get an idea of what kind of thing you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, what can be... For example, distributing flyers for an event.
Okay.
If you want to distribute it widely, or even if you're doing it social media digitally, it's going to be much less costly. Something like that, volunteers can go a long way. Something that is pretty general, like the task doesn't ask too much specialized skills.
Right.
I'm trying and failing to find very specialized volunteers, which makes sense because if you have a very specialized, very in-demand skill,
right.
It's not traditionally a volunteer job, right?
Right.
So makes sense. But I think there's going to be a lot of you're a volunteer for EA Global Conference right now, so there's an example.
It's true.
Stuff like that. And I think a career switch, we've made the jump, but it's a huge jump for many people. And I think something that can be improved in the effective altruists and the AI safety people's discussions is they basically, a lot of them say, if you don't switch your careers, you're not serious about this. I guess you're lucky in that maybe this has toned down since the beginning, since a few years ago.
Okay.
So maybe you're a bit newer into...
I'm not very deep into it.
Oh, okay.
I don't have a ton of experience.
You're deep enough to volunteer for it.
I volunteered at the first one because it made it free.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I don't have a lot of money right now.
I see. Make that donate button. That, trust
okay.
me.
The first one, the main reason that I went to the first one was because I have a friend that lives in Boston.
Right.
So the only cost there, I actually paid for the flight with points. So it was literally a free trip.
Oh, okay. Congratulations.
Which is I think if I hadn't been able to make it free, I probably wouldn't have been able to go.
Yeah. So I think a lot of... By the way, this is a side that's really useful here. Just reducing the friction to collaborations between people on Team Human is very important. Stuff like this. There's a lot of sludge in real life as well. A lot of it is very unintentional and kind of boring too. Things like
laundry.
Laundry. What I meant was sometimes, for example, people feel like it's impolite to reach out to people with certain skills. Mm. But I think just cold emailing people, if you think they're strongly pro-human like you, strongly want to make a positive difference,
mm-hmm.
I think downside is basically zero. So I think people, for example, this skill is generally called agency. Just you know, if you set your mind to it, if you have that goal, you can do things like fix your sleep schedule or just reach out to people even though you're nervous. You can just do that if you just decide.
Commit to it,
exactly. Yeah. So that's probably a very important skill that can be used for good or evil. Unfortunately, evil is possible too.
Right.
So anyway, number two is volunteer, which I think is very helpful for a lot of tasks, maybe not the most specialized ones, but still. And I think a lot of nonprofits, as a nonprofit co-founder, it's important to mention that, you always want someone like full-time or someone who's like 100% on the staff of your nonprofit. Like they should be prepared enough where they can represent your nonprofit, and they will be prepared enough where they can represent your nonprofit to stakeholders. You can like go meet stakeholders, and we can't expect a volunteer to have that same level of preparation, because the volunteer is a volunteer basis. They spend way less time on just, you know, knowing about the fundamentals of the whole strategy of the nonprofit and so
right.
on, right?
Yeah.
So a nonprofit cannot rely on solely volunteers. They have to rely on a strong core of full-time staff. But volunteers can be very, very helpful difference maker in a lot of different kinds of tasks.
Okay.
And in, for example, I think college students are great volunteers if they're close to you.
Yes, but they are not once that you're off campus.
That's right. So another thing is, if you know, there are a lot of, I guess, middle-aged people, maybe even some elderly people who have cars and who have free time. That's another great potential people who might be enthusiastic about volunteering. Because if you have a car and if you have a free time, you can get to your volunteering location, right? If there's a location involved. So these are some practical, I would say, tips that I've been told over the
No, that's
months.
Super, it's really helpful, because like, right now I would say I'm in the similar situation. Like, I'm technically working part-time. I think last week I worked 2 hours.
Yeah.
In the thing that I get paid for.
So I think it's very interesting. So for-profit companies, especially the big tech companies, they have boatloads of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have a move that's very, not always helpful, but can be helpful theoretically, which is hire someone new to do the work. So if you have this much work and you don't have enough people to do it, hire one extra person. For nonprofit, this is much more of a costly move, right? Because like, if you hire someone, you better think like, if you, for example, like we're all co-founders who just wanted to like have urgent impactful situations of, you know, making, you know, advancing AI safety,
right,
that we neglected fundraising, which is again kind of like, you know, we need to at some point decide to agentically be sustainable in our impact, so we have
to
make that.
Once you do that, then you're gonna increase it
exactly overall. You have to just nip it in the bud, even though it might have been reasonable in an emergency situation. But let's say you're co-founders and you're bringing on an early employee.
Mm-hmm.
You better make sure you can pay your early employee the salary for like at least a medium term, because that's just a responsible thing to do. So for nonprofits, we play like some disadvantages compared to for-profits is that the nonprofit is not owned by anyone. There are employees, like even the co-founders are employees, but it's not owned by anyone. One disadvantage is that because of this like lack of ownership, there's less funding. It's often mostly donations, or even if there's even if there's like profitable activities, I think there's a pretty strong causal effect where if you're a nonprofit, you have less funding to throw on than for-profit companies. And big tech companies, there's no contest. Like, they just have boatloads of money.
Right.
They don't even know what to do with it. They just create train models and give it to everyone for free. It just boggles the mind. Anyway, so given that the move of hire someone extra to do work X that you don't have time to do currently, that move is much harder for nonprofits. Project prioritization is very, very important. I've heard this multiple times with different nonprofit leaders. So, like, again, also researchers, right? As a researcher, you, I mean, some, I guess some PIs somehow get huge grants, right? And they can hire huge staffs. But a lot of PIs and a lot of researchers, they, it's usually just their time or, like, you know, if you're a professor and you have, like, maybe five grad students, like, you have six people's time that you want to allocate or advise people to allocate in good ways for what you think is, like, a good way to advance the understanding and prediction capabilities of humanity.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, so, but this is a disadvantage that you have limited time and resources and you need to be very careful with what you do. But the advantage of this is that you get really good at it because of that constraint. And so this improves your truth-seeking ability and your ability to look at the costs and benefits of different projects in different situations. So I don't know. I feel like, again, there are forces against this, right? Like, even nonprofits and academics are, you know, subject to groupthink as well. And, you know, such as the groupthink of machine learning academia falling into this atheoretical trap,
right,
and achieving nothing until somebody just started, you know, stacking transformers and then just doing SGD on it and, you know, getting big tech funding, and it worked. So
right,
there is a, you know, groupthink is, of course, a big, big problem in academia as well. But I think, yeah, I think these are some lessons that I've learned as being a nonprofit co-founder. And I think this is useful for anyone too, because if you're a human, you have a finite amount of time,
right,
and money and attention that you don't want to spend to whatever, like, you know, romantic dates or, like, you know, hobbies, and of course work and, you know, community and all those things, right? Family. And, like, you have to prioritize, right?
Right.
And if you try to achieve all of them, you will achieve none of them. It's a very common maxim in life. So it's this kind of mindset is useful for every person. So I think, especially for a nonprofit, it has been very, very, very useful.
But yeah, I definitely agree. I've mentioned that multiple times on the pod. I do mini-sodes where, like, give advice. At least they have been so far. I'm
gonna
change it to, like, reading papers, because it's really hard to research, like, 15 minutes of content to just, like, monologue the screen.
Yeah, I think you can get into situations where you, a proxy is like, oh, if I do a lot of these little, like, readings, I could get a greater understanding, but and you maximize it. But, like, you could be doing a bunch of stuff and then not making progress in terms of understanding. That happens a lot, right? So
yeah,
sometimes you just have to read the paper.
Yeah.
And read it again and again until you understand it. Like,
yep.
It's like a loop, maybe five times or something.
That's the one I'm I just wrote and recorded,
right,
one on reading papers.
Yeah. Oh, hey, you're very fundamental. That's really good.
Yeah. I mean, the idea was to be a resource for people,
right,
who are, like, starting.
Right.
And I guess that leads me into the final question, as long as you have enough time.
Yeah. I have, like, 5 minutes.
Okay. We'll do it real quick, which is, let's say someone's like, okay, I'm convinced, I'm full in, and either I don't really, like, have much commitment to my current career, like, I wasn't really interested in it in the first place, I want to do a career switch, or I'm in a position where I haven't yet, like, solidified where my direction. What are the steps or the things to do that you think would be helpful for someone who's like, yeah, I want to get into this area. This is the area that I feel passionately enough about to actually, like, try to make my career.
That's a really important question, because good as we're ending on it. Number one, you need to understand the current reality of the situation. And get to the point where you can also keep up with the situation as it changes rapidly, especially for AI, which changes so rapidly.
Okay.
So you need to, for AI, you need to go to an event like EAG Bay Area, at the very least. You need to just go and make a concerted effort to talk to everyone who is seriously working on this, and they're spending their entire lives and careers devoted to this.
Okay.
A lot of them will be wrong. A lot of them also will be... It's kind of sad, because, like, if you think you know, if you think all the solutions are bad and, you know, a miracle needs to happen, which a lot of us think, then, you know, if you might be like, oh, I'm going to do this, and you might have a desperation-fueled, like, confidence in a plan that's not going to work. Mm. There's a lot of groupthink, of course. So most people will be wrong, especially in a pre-paradigmatic and rapidly evolving field such as AI safety. But you still have to talk to everyone just to get the information on the ground truth of what the problem is.
Okay.
And you need to get to a point where you have a strong level of confidence of, like, what is a problem in my estimation, and, like, how can I solve it with the skills and with the network, with the potential, you know, co-founders, even if you're founding a nonprofit, that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a first step, is talk to everyone who's seriously thinking about this and devoting all their attention and time to this, and pick their brains. But have the intellectual independence to assume they're wrong, unless they convince you otherwise.
Okay.
And then make your own model of the problem. That's step one. Step two, do the thing that, given your understanding, like, what you can do to help do that thing. Or just, you know, sometimes the best thing is, like, I do my previous job and donate, or I volunteer. Sometimes, like, I really do think if we want a big tent, we need people of varying levels, right? And varying commitment levels, and also varying roles, right? So,
right.
No shame in that at all. But I do think if you're seriously considering career pivot, step one is talk to everyone, as many people as you can, who you trust, I guess generally talk to as many people as you can who are working full time on this, and pick their brains. Then decide based on the ground truth of what, you know, your believed ground truth of the current problem and how it's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
If that, what that step is going to vary. I think some common paths are do a PhD, because a PhD is a job where you can write papers about whatever you want for 5 years and get paid for it. Not a lot, but get paid for it.
And then you get
to be called doctor at the end. So,
that's true.
So this is one option that's quite generally applicable. Another option is founding a nonprofit. This is probably very underappreciated, because, like, there's a lot of...
Because nonprofits are underappreciated.
Yeah, nonprofits are underappreciated. And there's a lot of agency in, you know, founding anything, and it's a nonprofit. It's something with some, I would say, you definitely need some, like, sense of I have this mission and I want to really help people to get through that hump in terms of your agency. Another one, of course, is work from the inside in either the government or the AI companies. Of course, if you're going to work from the AI companies, I'm a bit skeptical given recent events that people can have, you know, be the pivotal difference maker in emergency situations as safety team number one. Maybe safety team number one can make a big public fuss about it, and maybe they can actually avoid the fate of just being fired as safety team number one, and safety team number two just doing what the CEO wanted them to do anyway. So maybe they can avoid that if they're smart. But I do think the fact that almost all employees of OpenAI threatened to leave massively for Microsoft, which is at great personal cost to them because it would destroy their OpenAI equity. The fact that they made this irrational decision because of groupthink fueled by financial and personal conflicts of interest does show that, at the very least, it's not guaranteed that just because you're, you know, the smartest and most moral person, even if you're thrown in that soup, you might just become part of the soup.
I'm gonna steal you in the soup.
Right.
but you know, in theory, like, if there was, you can't rule it out, but it is quite difficult. But the inside game in government and in, you know, relevant organizations like think tanks and academia and potentially even AI industry as well, although there are financial and other conflicts of interest that might impede you, those are some options on the table. And
sure.
I think the option you choose will depend on your belief, your model of what the situation is, like,
mm-hmm.
What you think it's actually going on, how it's likely to change the future, and what your skill sets are.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to believe in your skill set and your confidence in what the problem is in reality, rather than what other people are telling you how it looks like.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Necessary but not sufficient, of course. Anyone could be wrong too, even if they think all of these things. So, I'm sorry the advice is not perfect.
No, I mean, it's good to know, and it helps me build, like, a good model of things.
Yes.
Last question, which is really short.
Of course.
How often are people, like, referencing Spider-Man?
I'd say, like, probably less than you think, but more than zero.
Okay. do you like that reference or no?
I like it, I guess.
Okay, cool.
Spider-Man. Although, I think... I like it, I guess. Yeah, I like it.
Okay, so...
yeah.
The S stands for Spider-Man. That's
Well, you can think about it like that. But that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's perfect.
I mean, it's better than being the villain, for sure. So... I do think, like, you know, Spider-Man, like, is there a better way you could use his talents? Maybe. Something. Because, like, for example, Superman, he just beats up criminals, right?
Right.
But he could just give free energy to everyone if he just ran in circles. But
yeah,
it's not cool.
True.
So maybe there's something like that for Spider-Man. Maybe not, but yeah.
See, we got to the important questions by the end. Before I sign off, I'd like to give a huge thank you to Dr. Peter Park for meeting with me and providing so many great resources, Brian Penny for connecting me with Dr. Park, and AI Safety Camp for connecting me with Brian Penny. So, I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but I will be taking a brief hiatus from posting on the RSS feed for a little while, but I will still be publishing hackathon episodes to my Patreon. I'll also be keeping the Patreon up to date with my current plans, so definitely check it out. Note, you don't have to be a patron to see my posts and participate on the platform. With this interview series at an end, I just have one thing left to say. So long, Spider-Man!